Roberta Flack on vocals and piano with Compared to What, one of the grittiest protest anthems of all time, made famous by pianist, composer, vocalist Les McCann and saxophonist Eddie Harris, who also is the inventor of the electrified saxophone. Compared to What, Flack's first single, appeared on her debut album, First Take, in 1969, shortly after Les McCann and Eddie Harris presented it at the Montreux Jazz Festival. When Flack recorded her version, Les McCann was her producer. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we're going a little bit philosophical today. Seeing or trying to see the connective tissue between things that otherwise seem so unrelated. And we'll start with the sad news of the death of Linda Brown, who was at the center of the famed Board versus Brown versus Board of Education federal case that went all the way to the Supreme Court. Linda Brown's parents, Leola and Oliver Brown, wanted to enroll their 9-year-old daughter in an elementary school just a few blocks from their home in Topeka, Kansas. The school refused to admit her. Instead, Brown's parents were advised to send their daughter to an all-black school clear across town. And thus began a protracted legal battle that confronted and finally broke educational apartheid in America with a U.S. Supreme Court ruling in 1954 that outlawed the separate but equal doctrine that states routinely had used to keep intact their systems of educational apartheid. Preferring to lead a quiet life, Brown eschewed attention although she occasionally would give talks on the landmark case. She died this past Sunday, and her family has given no further information. But let's hear her give a short synopsis of what this case was all about. Here's Linda Brown.
Come in today to be with you and talk about Brown versus the Board of Education and our part in that historic case, and reminisce with me some 50 years ago when my family became part of Brown versus the Board of Education. It all started for me on a balmy day in the fall of 1950 in the quiet Kansas town of Topeka, when a mild-mannered black man took his plump 7-year-old daughter by the hand and walked briskly 4 blocks from their home to the all-white school and tried without success to enroll his child. The child of whom I speak was I, Linda Carroll Brown, and my father, the late Reverend Oliver Leon Brown. Black parents in Topeka felt that the day of trying to enroll their children in the school nearest to their home was long overdue. Many were the evenings my father would arrive home to find my mother almost in tears because I would get halfway to the school bus stop, which was a 7-block walk from my home. I could only make half that walk because the cold would get too bitter for a small child to bear. I can still remember starting that bitter walk and the terrible cold that would cause my tears to freeze upon my face. I would return running as fast as I could. I had to cross a very busy avenue in order to catch the school bus, which would carry me more than 2 miles across town to the all-black Monroe Public School. These were the circumstances which so angered black parents. My father pondered why. Why should our children have to travel so far to school, facing unbearable winter weather, waiting for a badly overcrowded school bus to carry them some 2 miles across town when there is a school only 4 blocks from our home? Why? Why must I have to spend time trying to explain to my child that she cannot go to school with her neighborhood playmates, who are predominantly white, Native American, and Hispanic, because her skin is black? In the face of this discouragement, he, along with 12 other parents, met with the local NAACP and their lawyer, Charles S. Scott, a local attorney, to make plans for each family to try and enroll their child in the white school nearest their home during September 1950. After trying enrollment and being turned down, a suit was filed in federal court in February of 1951. During the following July, the federal 3-judge panel heard testimony from my father, along with several of the other parents, who agreed that segregated schools for blacks were unequal. I, along with my father, had to appear in court, but unlike him, I was not asked to appear on the witness stand. The case was argued before a 3-judge federal court in Topeka and was decided in favor of the Board of Education and its segregated elementary schools. In Topeka, the issue was not so much integrating public schools to improve the quality of instruction, but rather the inaccessibility of the neighborhood schools. Black people were able to live all over town, but could not expect to send their children to the schools closest to their home. At the Supreme Court level, the case was consolidated with similar cases and argued in terms of the psychological damage brought about by segregation in public education. Experts from the psychiatric community were pulled in to examine whether or not segregation, in fact, served to break a youngster's morale and block the development of a strong, positive self-concept so essential to educational progress. My family became lost in the turmoil of the ensuing years, years that scarcely touched us. We lived in the calm of the hurricane's eye, gazing out at the storm around us and wondering how it would all end. I don't think my father ever got discouraged, but at this particular time, neither I nor my parents knew how far-reaching this suit would become. During the next 3 years, while the now famous decision was in the making, my father was called into the ministry. He received a charge in the fall of 1953, and the family moved to the northern part of the city, where we became the first family of the St. Mark AME Church. I was transferred to the all-black McKinley Elementary School in North Topeka, again facing the same situation of having to walk twice the distance it would have taken me to reach the all-white school just 3 blocks from my home. Time stood still as the highest court of the land pondered over Brown versus Board of Education, until an afternoon in May of 1954, when I was in school, my father at work, and my mother at home doing the family ironing and listening to the radio. At 12:52 p.m., the announcement came. The court's decision on ending segregation was unanimous. My mother was overwhelmed. On returning from school, I learned of the decision, which at that time meant only to me that my sisters wouldn't have to walk so far to school the next fall. That evening in our home was much rejoicing. I remember seeing tears of joy in the eyes of my father as he embraced us, repeating, "Thanks be unto God." That night, the family attended a rally given by the local NAACP and held at the Monroe Public School. The following school term was so very different, but not for me, because I was never to benefit from the now famous decision. For during the 54 school term, I entered junior high school, which was already on an integrated basis, as were the high schools in the city. Integration in the city in the fall of 1954 went very smoothly. It seemed as though blacks and whites had been going to school together for years. Neither I nor my family suffered the abuse or racial strife that marked integration in the latter 50s and early 60s in so many parts of the country. We were very fortunate, my father would often say. He believed very strongly that God would move people to do the right thing. The latter 50s found my family living in Springfield, Missouri, where my father held the pastorate of Benton Avenue AME Church. At this time, newspapers and magazines began to do follow-ups on me and my family because the significance of the Supreme Court decision, which carried our name, was beginning to really take hold throughout the country. It was during this time that I inherited much of the recognition that might have gone to my father had it not been for his untimely death in 1961 at the age of 42. If he had lived, I'm sure he would have become a strong civil rights activist in the movements of the 60s. Little did he know that years ago, when he stepped off the witness stand, he stepped into the pages of history. I didn't understand what was happening then, but it was clear that Brown versus the Board of Education was a necessary victory. It might have been a little flame, but it served to set off a mighty flame. To me, the impact of Brown is best seen in the increasing numbers of black professionals today. These are the people that, after 1954, were able to have some degree of choice. This surely made a difference in their aspirations and their achievements. I ran across a quote in a new book by one of our black women authors. Her name is Mildred Pitts Walters, that I believe says it all. It is not the treatment of a people that degrades them, but their acceptance of it. Thank you.
Linda Brown, giving a talk in 2004. She was not known for wanting the limelight, and even up until her death, insisted that no big fuss be made about it. But let's talk about what she conveyed to us in that little synopsis. What she said was that were it not for the persistence of her father in particular, but of course her mother as well, this entire case may not have occurred. So the germ of resistance was in the household itself, as it was in many other households. Imagine the entire country operating on a system that they wish to convey to you is fair. The system of separate but equal. The idea is that you should believe, as a black person, a black parent, and even a black child, you should believe the government's best intentions to offer you exactly the same opportunities as white children in this country. Because, after all, this is the land of freedom and equality. How could the government possibly be suspected of conducting decades and decades and decades of educational apartheid, dooming many, many brilliant children to a life of whatever, whatever happens, you'll have to accept it. But you can't say that you're not being educated. As you know, education is one of my big things. But imagine if that man, her father, Oliver, and her mother, Leola, had not stood up and said, "This will not be the fate of my child." Imagine what would have happened. We would still be struggling with this question about parity, about fairness. But he stood up. And 12 other parents also stood up, even though they were intimidated, even though they were fearful, even though the insistence for fairness, wanting the same thing for their children that every parent would want, a good education in a school with well-trained teachers, so that their children would have a promising future, which is a universal need, a universal want. And, might I say, you would hope a universal recognition and a universal duty on the part of a government that says it is for freedom and fairness and justice and all the other high-minded ideals. Now, she's talking to us in 2004. And even then, the system was unequal and separate, as it is now. It has reversed itself for just the little time that it publicly committed to doing the right thing. It quickly reversed itself and more deeply entrenched this inequality in education. We talk about it all the time here. What the government, as a system of socialization, which is what school is, education, it's one of the most important ways in which people are socialized into a society. We are hearing reports, and we've heard them time and again, that the system perhaps is more entrenched in apartheid more than ever. Great cities have Bantustans, like New York, and Chicago, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Washington, D.C. Their children have already been consigned to a lifetime of inferiority. They dare not hold on to the dreams that Linda's father and mother thought that their child deserved to have a shot at. You send your children to school, and by the time they leave, you cannot vouch for what has happened to their brains between the time you see them off to school and the time they come back home to you. And there are all kinds of reasons, all kinds of theories as to why this powerful nation simply cannot deliver on one simple idea. And that is, all children are entitled to a sound education. They can't deliver on that. And the odd thing is that the black schools, founded in many ways by former enslaved people, that was the first thing they invested in, an education for their children. I shared with you a very powerful moment that I had helping a friend put together her family reunion project. And family members from all over sent their pictures and then historical documents and so forth, so that every reunion produces a historical document. And I came upon this picture of a ramshackle, it looked like a shack, a lean-to. And in front of this shack was a teacher, a very young teacher. You can see she might have been about 17 at the time, but dressed in her Sunday best, including a hat. And there were about 30 children, also dressed in their very best. And that was their school and their school teacher. The family, one of the families in this large contingent pooled their resources, their very meager resources. And the first thing they did was buy a plot of land. And then the next thing they did was build this little shack, because they were determined that their children would read and write. And then they put some more money together and placed an advertisement in neighboring towns for a school teacher. And this was the school teacher who showed up and got the job. Such was the value of education. And it's not unique to African Americans. All oppressed, severely oppressed people, this is the one thing they are sure of. And that is that their legacy depends on securing a sound education for their children. We see the connective tissue here because we heard of this horrible event in Parkland, Florida, where a student, a former student with severe mental problems, showed up on the campus of his former high school and mowed down 17 people. Most of them students, three administrators, killed them all with an assault rifle. And all we could hear from officialdom was that, you know, what drove this young man and how could this have happened and all these questions. Meanwhile, they would not say that Parkland itself, in its early days, was a community that had its own vision of itself, mimicking the old style of living in America. It was to be racially pure. It was an island unto itself, this community. And it was sold as, especially to white people, of course, they didn't sell Parkland to anybody else. It sold, the developers sold Parkland and other such communities as the ideal place to be white in America. You have your own police department, you have your own great schools, and these schools are feeder schools into very fine universities. And you have the added advantage of sunshine, abundant sunshine, the Florida life. And your savings and your retirement will go so much farther down the road, if you were to come to these areas and live apart from the riffraff and all the institutions that will support this kind of life are already in place waiting for you. Well, we saw that illusion was shattered on Valentine's Day this year with this massacre. And it wasn't so much about education that people were worried about then. It was how did it come to this? What did we miss? How did it come to this? But again, you know, life is very interesting. In the midst of their shock, in the midst of their sorrow, the students themselves fashioned a way. In the immediate instance, it was to address this matter of the availability of such lethal military-style weapons that would do maximum damage in minimum time. But if you listen very carefully to them, what are they saying? They're looking at the broader picture now. They're looking at the broader picture. And this generation is deciding that they are perfectly equipped for leadership on this question. They can play a major role and must play a major role in solving and calling out a system that supports the unwillingness to claim the reality with which many students are living, both in and outside of their communities. And so I'm sure when Linda Brown spoke in 2004, there was no way, nobody could see how connected really that struggle for equal education would be with this current struggle by these young people for a wholesome education. And now it has moved beyond Parkland to across the United States and across the world. And we're seeing more and more the commonalities, the shared interests, the shared enemy of democracy, which is an intransigent, racist system. It dawned on me, really, that Linda Brown died the day after this mass protest. And she should, although she just rejected any kind of, you know, that movie star treatment that people love to have, she was not one of those. That it should comfort her to know that that pudgy little 9-year-old girl who had a splendid father and a splendid mother who invested not just in her, but in all the other children similarly situated in their community and the other parents who did the same, they stood up. They faced down a major enemy, which was really a combination of enemies. Lives were in danger. People were threatened. People were even killed in pursuit of the simple idea of a basic quality education that all children in this country are entitled to. But they had to go to fight. They had to get people to volunteer their time. People like Constance Baker Motley and Thurgood Marshall, lawyers who were up to their eyeballs, trying to go through the courts, trying to do the right thing, trying to elicit some kind of a sane response. The problem is not that complicated. It is that your opposition is so strong to doing the right thing. The thing that you, your constitution says is the right thing to do. You won't do it. And you invent all these different ways of making sure it never gets done. But there are people who thankfully see and understand the importance of a struggle like that. And they give, literally in some cases, their lives to it. Now, here's what's very interesting. The young people from Parkland and part of this movement, what they want some, you know, changes made. But here is quite a whammy today. And the whammy comes from none other than a former U.S. Supreme Court justice who today, in an editorial he wrote, it was printed in the New York Times, goes beyond the demands, the very modest demands of these young people. And he says the entire Second Amendment ought to be repealed. Wow, that's a whammy. Former Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens is advocating the repeal, just remove the Second Amendment from the books, he says. He was an appointee of Gerald Ford, and he retired in 2010. And here's what he says. The march for our lives, our modern day struggles that we're seeing and witnessing, these demonstrations and civic engagement, and they demand respect. And they need to seek more lasting reform than the modest requests they have made so far. And what is more effective and more lasting reform? The repeal, he says, of the Second Amendment altogether. It had a purpose in the 1700s, and it was written in a particular environment, and neither the purpose nor the environment exists at the moment to require that the Second Amendment still stay on the books. Now, if you're following this thing, this happens to me from time to time, I think a lot about how things are connected. And in some of the smallest ways, small stories, you see the universe basically expressing itself. The universe saying, no matter how big your opponent is, you're much bigger than that. Linda's parents gave her firm footing, not just in terms of making a legal case, but in her character. So that even if she didn't want much attention drawn to herself as an adult, she continued her activism. She never let it die. So it's a great way to remember her today. That spark that she served as in her small town of Topeka, her small part of town of Topeka, that became a huge flame, ignited or has ignited other flames. So we thank her and we remember her with great respect. We take a little break and come back to your comments and observations right after this.
Go to church on Sunday, sleep and not try to duck the wrath of God. Preachers filling us with pride, telling what he thinks is right. But he must be some kind of stupid nut. He tries to make it real.
You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, and your calls to express your thoughts about what I just talked about at 888-874-4888. We'll start in Orlando with Tony. You're on the air.
Hi, Eutrice. Thanks for taking my call.
Hello.
I'm delighted to hear that news, what you just talked about, the Supreme Court Justice, former Supreme Court Justice, opinions on repealing the Second Amendment. I'm strongly against it because I've studied history. I know what it was written for. It was to, prevent an uprising, within this country, due to the ill-gotten spoils from, the white supremacists in this country. So I'm glad to hear that people are starting to think clearly about what it was about and what the intentions were, and that it's not something that we should tolerate anymore in this country. As far as education, I'm originally from New Jersey. It's ironic how education used to be segregated, but yet today it still is segregated in many ways, because what happened was during the civil rights movement, a lot of the white population moved out of inner cities and urban cities. And they moved into the suburbs. Well, I'm originally from New Brunswick, New Jersey. And there's rural towns around New Brunswick, New Jersey. You have North Brunswick, East Brunswick, South Brunswick. And many of those folks, they moved out of those towns. And they moved into those towns. They moved out of New Brunswick, moved into those towns. And basically, took all the money out.
You're
of
having a lot of interference from you, Tony. What's going on?
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yes, but there's a lot happening in the background.
Oh, yeah, like one caller said, all they do here is cut grass. Sorry about that. But what's going on in the cities up in many blue states is that they are basically zoning kids to school districts according to their zip code. So if you are in a low-income zip code, your kid basically only is allowed to go to that particular school district. And it might be a failing school district. And you don't have, as a parent, the choice to put your child in a better school district to give your child a better education. And
but that's been going on for a very long time. I mean, this idea of zoning people in or zoning them out of desirable school districts, we know that story. I want to ask... Okay, Tony, whatever is going on there, it's like a whirlwind of electronic activity. What I want to ask you is, as we talk about this issue today, you see the connective tissue at all between the Brown versus Board of Ed of 1954 and what these young people are doing today? Oh, well, we lost them all together. 888-874-4888. That's, are you there?
Yes.
Okay. So do you see any connective tissue at all?
Well,
Board of Ed and what the young, this nascent movement is trying to achieve?
Yes, and it's what you mentioned earlier was persistence. We need to remain persistent when trying to push a cause. And what these kids today and what happened back during Brown versus the Board of Education was that persistence. And we got to take legal action. Yesterday, I had called and I try to urge for a boycott of weapons, because it's that persistence of we gotta hit it at all types of angles, because they know it hits them in their pocket. This is a capitalist system; it hits them in the pocket, in the money. Whether it was the boycotts of the buses during the Rosa Parks a movement, or whether it's the lawsuit that against the Board of Education, these kids today, they got to get legal about. I mean, one thing is to protest. I mean, these kids, what they have a bigger bullhorn than what the previous protesters have had, because they grew up in the social media. They know how to use social media. They're young. These particular kids come from an affluent school district, and you can tell the difference between these kids and some other kids. You know, you can tell that school is not equal in this country, because these kids, they got a good education.
All right. Thank you. Thanks a lot for calling back in. And thank you for your contribution today, Tony. I really appreciate it. Leona from Michigan, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Utrice.
No problem at all.
Yes, I want to thank you for playing that clip from Linda Brown. I think that might have been the first time I ever heard her speak. And she shared a lot. And in terms of the connective tissue, I'm still thinking about that. However, some of the things that popped in my mind was how when Ms. Brown was talking, it sounded like this effort started off as maybe a transportation issue, perhaps, maybe, because, you know, her parents were concerned about her having to go, you know, to all way away from home versus, you know, a school that's right there within walking distance. And I think she said in her talk how, the Brown case was bundled up with some other cases, and eventually went to the Supreme Court. And I appreciate what you said about her father, Oliver Brown, and her mother, Leola Brown, and yes, and how they decided to resist, even though it was scary, even though it was dangerous. They decided, hooked up with 12 other families, and they decided to resist and fight for their children, fight for what was correct and proper, you know, that fight so that their children would not be mistreated. And I was surprised to learn her father died at the early age of 42 years old. I'm wondering if the stress of the fight might have contributed to him leaving here early, because it has happened.
I wouldn't doubt it at all. But it wasn't really a transportation issue, because this was typical in any, you could call it a mixed neighborhood.
Right.
They still would locate the all-black school in an area where most people would have to struggle to get there. And they didn't care.
Yes, ma'am. Right.
They did not care about that.
Yes, ma'am. Now, back with this connective tissue effort, you know, the rally recently in Washington, and I guess one of the things that's connected is the fact that they're both a form of resistance, perhaps, you know, what the Brown family and the other 12 families did and what these young people did in Washington. I guess it's a form of resistance. There's a connection there. However, I'm wondering if it's possible that both forms of resistance, although they are worthy and necessary, may miss the mark. Meaning, because with Brown v. Board of Education, schools are still so-called segregated today in 2018. And that thing, all deliberate speed, you know, what is that? You know, it's still. I don't know that the problem was. The problem has not been solved, I guess. And with the young people resisting, I don't know if this is going to be an emotional thing, whatever, and, you know, it dies down later, because it seemed like some of the same people are organizing this, and I could be wrong, but I think the Democratic Party has a good handle on this resistance rally that took place, this past weekend. And I couldn't help notice, though, that, you know, like you said, you didn't say it, but those students came from an affluent area, meaning they probably had a lot more opportunities than children in a lot of school districts. And I was, you know, it's good that they feel entitled to be in the safe space, which is good. We all are entitled to it, but depending on how. I mean, globally, you know, as I speak, there's children being killed right now. Innocent children in other parts of the world being killed right now.
I see your point, but I will also say, let's take a look at the level of responsibility in each instance, whether in the Brown versus Board of Education case or the current discussion that we're having about the Parkland case. It's about what level of responsibility is one willing to accept and take, in behalf, as an advocate, as an activist, in redressing a horrible situation. I don't agree that the Democratic Party has basically, you know, a big foothold in this movement. I think they would try, of course, any politically organized, because they have failed utterly. The Democratic Party has failed utterly in the matter of education. Look who we got as the Secretary of Education. And we haven't seen a consistent effort on the part of the Democratic Party, including from Michigan, where she is and where you are from, to really deal with the problems. And we've laid them out time and again on this program, what the problems are, major problems with education. But I think we have to, at some point, I mean, it is absolutely guaranteed that the movement will come under severe attack. But we have to understand, too, that they're prepared for it. They're prepared. And they're moving ahead. That's the main thing. They are moving ahead, and in such a short time have gained a lot of ground and redirected the conversation in so many ways, about not just about gun control, but standards of education and the responsibilities of government to deliver a basic human need and right. Thanks, Leona, for your call today.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Thanks. That brings us to the end of our program. I just thought, you know, I was thinking this way of just putting these things together, how life works out, that things that seem so totally disconnected or unconnected, either by time or by space or by whatever chance, whatever it is that would seem to normally not have these things connect, but they do connect. Stay tuned. Coming up next, The Infectious Myth with David Crow. And I thank you so much for listening today. Bye-bye.
And I hate that human love, that stinking mud. Trying to make it real. But compared to what? Said the president, he's got his war. Folks don't know just what it's for.